Chapter 4. The waiting room was empty. Plants with long, leathery leaves stood on a shelf by the window. On the table lay magazines, the covers showing pictures of party bigwigs, soldiers, a detachment of Hitler Youth. I heard swift steps. Martin stood in the doorway. He stared at me, took off his glasses, and blinked. The light in the waiting room was dim. He did not recognize me at first, probably because of my mustache. "It is I, Rudolph," I said. "It's Josef." He motioned me to speak softly. "Where have you come from?" he whispered. I shrugged. "What did that matter?" "I'm here," I said. "You've got to help me." He looked at me. His nearsighted eyes in the dim light seemed like the eyes of a fish in a bowl. "Have you permission to be here?" "Only from myself."
"How did you cross the border?"
"That doesn't matter. I've come to see Helen." He gaped at me.
"So that's what you came for?"
"Yes," I said. Suddenly, I felt calm. I had been trembling as long as I was alone. Now all my agitation left me. My problem was to calm my perturbed friend.
"To see Helen?"
he asked. "Yes, to see Helen. And you've got to help me."
"Good God," he said.
"Is she dead?" I asked.
"No, she is not dead."
"Is she in town?"
"Yes, at least she was a week ago."
"Can we speak here?" I asked. Martins nodded.
"I've sent my receptionist away. If any patients turn up, I can send them away too. I can't ask you to my home. I've married 2 years ago. You understand?"
I understood. Relatives were not to be trusted in the Thousand-Year Reich. Denunciation was looked upon as a national virtue by the saviors of Germany. Of that I had first-hand experience. It was my wife's brother who had denounced me.
"My wife isn't in the party," said Martins quickly. "But we've never..."
He looked at me with confusion.
"Discussed a case like this one. I'm not exactly sure what she would think. Come in here."
He opened the door of his consultation room and locked it behind us. "Leave it open," I said. "A locked room is more suspicious than if we were to be seen." He turned the key back in the lock and looked at me.
"Josef, for God's sake, what are you doing here? Have you come secretly?"
"Yes, and you don't have to hide me. I'm staying at a hotel outside the city. I've come to you because you're the only one who could let Helen know I am here. I haven't heard from her in 5 years. I don't know what's become of her. I don't know even whether she has remarried. If she has..."
"And that's why you've come?"
"Yes," I replied in astonishment. "Why else would I come?"
"We've got to hide you," he said. "You can spend the night here on the couch. I'll wake you before 7. At 7, the maid comes in to clean up. After 8, you can come back. There are no patients before 11.
"Is she married?" I asked.
"Helen?"
He shook his head.
"I don't even think she's divorced from you."
"Where is she living?"
"In the old apartment?"
"I think so." "Is anyone living with her?"
"What do you mean?"
"Her mother, her sister, her brother, or some other relative."
"I'm not sure."
"You've got to find out," I said. "And you've got to tell her I'm here."
"Why don't you tell her yourself?" Martins asked. "There's the phone."
"And suppose she's not alone? What if her brother is there? He has already denounced me once."
"That's true.
She'd probably be just as flabbergasted as I was. That could give her away." "I don't even know how she feels about me, Rudolph. It's been 5 years, and we were only married for 4. 5 years are more than 4.
and separation cuts more ice than a life together. He nodded. I don't understand you, he said. I can see that. I don't understand myself either. We lead different lives. Why didn't you write her? I can't explain all that now, Rudolph. Go to see Helen. Talk to her. Find out how she feels. If it seems like the right thing to do, tell her I'm here and ask her how we can meet. When do you want me to go? Right away, I said, startled. Why wait? He looked around. Where will you go in the meantime? It's not safe here. My wife is likely to send the maid down for me. I usually go upstairs after my office hours. She's used to it. I could lock you in, but that would look suspicious. I don't need to be locked in, I said. Can't you tell your wife you have to visit a patient? I'll tell her that when I come back. It's simpler. I saw a twinkle in his eyes, and for a moment the left one seemed to wink ever so slightly. That reminded me of our childhood days. I'll wait in the cathedral. Nowadays churches are almost as safe as in the Middle Ages. When should I call you up? In an hour. Say your name is Otto Sturm. How can I find you? Wouldn't you rather go someplace where there's a phone? Places with phones are dangerous. Yes, maybe so. For a moment he stood hesitant. Yes, maybe you're right. If I'm not back, call again or leave a message saying where you are. Good. I took my hat. Joseph, he said. I turned around. How is it out there? He asked. You know what I mean, without everything. Without everything? I answered. Yes, that's about it, without everything, but not entirely. And how is it here? With everything except the one thing that counts. Not so good, he said. Not so good, Joseph, but shiny on the surface. I took the emptiest streets to the cathedral. It was not far. In Kronstrasse, a company of marching soldiers passed me. They were singing a song I did not know. On the Domplatz, there were more soldiers. A little farther off, by the three crosses of the little church, a crowd had gathered. 200 or 300 people, most of them in party uniform. I heard a voice and looked for the speaker. There wasn't one. Finally, my eyes lit on a black loudspeaker propped up on a platform. It stood there under a light, naked and alone, an automaton, screaming about the right to reconquer every inch of German soil, the greater Germany, revenge. The peace of the world, it roared, could be safeguarded in only one way. The world must do what Germany wanted. That was right and just. The wind had risen again, and the swaying branches cast their restless shadows on the faces, the howling machine, and the silent stone sculptures on the church wall behind them. Christ on the cross between the two thieves. The faces of the listeners were concentrated and transfigured. They believed what the automaton was screaming at them. In a strange state of hypnosis, they applauded this disembodied voice as if it were a human being. The scene struck me as typical of the sinister, demonic mob spirit of our times, of all the frightened, hysterical crowds who follow slogans. It makes no difference whether the slogans come from the right or the left, as long as they relieve the masses of the hard work of thinking and of the need to take responsibility. I hadn't expected to find so many people in the cathedral. Then I remembered that services were held every evening in May. For a moment I wondered whether a Protestant church mightn't be better, but I didn't know whether they were open in the evening. I squeezed into an empty pew near the entrance. There was a blaze of candles at the altar, but the rest of the church was dimly lighted. and it would not have been easy to recognize me. The priest moved about the altar in a cloud of incense and candlelight, surrounded by altar boys in red cassocks and white surplices, one of them swinging the steaming censer. I heard the organ and the singing, and it seemed to me that I was looking upon the same transfigured faces as outside, the same ecstatic sleepwalker's eyes, full of unquestioning faith and yearning for security without responsibility. The atmosphere in the church was gentler, milder, but this religion, which tells us to love God and our neighbor, had not always been so mild. In long centuries of darkness, it too had shed a great deal of blood. The moment it had ceased to be persecuted, it had begun to persecute in turn, with fire and sword and rack. Helen's brother had made that point when he spoke to me in the concentration camp. "We have taken over the methods of your church. Your Inquisition, with its torture in God's name, taught us how to deal with enemies of the faith. Actually, we are not so cruel. It's only in special cases that we burn people alive." I was hanging on a cross when he said that to me. That was one of their gentler ways of getting information out of prisoners. The priest at the altar raised the golden monstrance and blessed the congregation. I sat very still, but I felt as if I were floating in a tepid bath of incense, consolation, and light. Then the last hymn struck up, "Be thou in this night my shield and my guard." I had sung that as a child. In those days the darkness of night had frightened me. Now it was the light that I feared. The people began to leave. I had another 15 minutes to wait. I slid into a corner beside a great pillar that supported the vaulting. At that moment, I saw Helen. I didn't recognize her at first, because I hadn't expected her here. Then, when she had gone a few steps past me and reached a spot where the crowd had thinned out, I recognized her by the way she moved her shoulders in working her way forward. She didn't seem to touch anyone, but to glide in between people. Suddenly she was standing almost disengaged in the wide center aisle, against the candles and the blue and red darkness of the tall Romanesque windows. She looked small and slender and lost. I stood up, trying to catch her eye. I didn't dare to beckon. There were still too many people. It would have attracted attention. "She's alive," was my first thought. "She's not dead and she's not sick." In our situation, that's always the first thought. You're so surprised that something is still the same as before, that someone is still there. She hurried on to the choir. I slipped out of my pew and followed her. At the communion rail, she stopped and turned around. She carefully examined the people still kneeling in the pews, then returned slowly down the aisle. I stood still. She was so sure of finding me in one of the pews that she passed right beside me, so close that we almost touched. I followed her. When she stopped again, I stopped right behind her. "Helen," I said, "don't turn around. Go outside, I'll follow you. We mustn't be seen here." She quivered as if she had been struck, but she went on. Why on earth had she come here? We were in great danger of being recognized, but I myself hadn't known there would be so many people. I saw her walking along ahead of me, but all I felt was impatience to be out of the church as quickly as possible. She had on a black suit and a very small hat, and she held her head very erect and a little to the side as though listening to my footsteps. I lagged a few steps behind, remaining just near enough to keep her in sight. I had learned by experience that you are often recognized simply because you are too close to someone else. She passed by the stone holy water fonts and through the great portal. Then she turned left. Alongside the cathedral, there was a broad walk paved with stone flags, barred off from the square by iron chains affixed to sandstone posts. She jumped over the chains, took a few steps into the darkness, stopped, and turned around. When I say that I felt in that moment that this was my life, my whole life walking ahead of me and apparently away from me, and then suddenly it turned back to me, that's another cliché, and it's both true and untrue. Just the same, I felt it. But that wasn't all I felt. I walked toward Helen, toward her dark figure, toward her pale face and her eyes and her mouth, and I left behind me everything that had been. The years during which we had not been together did not evaporate. They still existed, but they were something I had read about, not something I had experienced. "Where have you come from?" Helen asked in a tone that was almost hostile before I had reached her. "From France." "And they let you in?" "No, I crossed the border illegally." Those were almost the same questions that Martin's had asked.
"Why?"
she asked. "To see you."
"You shouldn't have come."
"I know. I said the same thing to myself day after day."
"And why have you come?"
"If I knew that, I wouldn't be here." I didn't dare to kiss her. She stood right in front of me, but so rigid I thought she might break if I touched her. I didn't know what she might be thinking, but I had seen her again. She was alive, and now I could go, or wait to see what would happen.
"You don't know?" she asked.
"I'll know tomorrow, or next week, or later." I looked at her. What was there to know? Knowledge was a speck of foam dancing on top of a wave. Every gust of wind could blow it away, but the wave remained.
"You've come," she said.
Her face lost its rigidity and grew gentle. She came a step closer. I held her by the arms, and her hands were pressed against my chest as though to hold me at a distance. I had the feeling that we had stood a long while face to face and alone on the dark, windy square. The street sounds seemed muffled, as though cut off from us by a glass wall. At the end of the square to the left of me, about 100 paces distant, lay the brightly lighted Stadt Theater with its white steps. And for a moment, I remember, I was vaguely surprised that plays were still being shown, and that the theater hadn't been turned into barracks or a prison. A group of people passed us. One of them laughed, and some of them looked around at us.
"Come," Helen whispered, "we can't stay here."
"Where can we go?"
"To your apartment."
I thought I must have heard wrong. "Where?" I asked again.
"To your apartment. Where else?"
"Someone might recognize me on the stairs. Aren't the same people living in the house as before?"
"They won't see you."
"And the maid?"
"I'll give her the night off."
"And tomorrow morning?"
Helen looked at me. "Have you come so far just to ask such questions?"
"I haven't come to be caught and sent to a concentration camp, Helen." At last she smiled.
"Joseph," she said, "you haven't changed. How did you ever get here?"
"I don't know myself," I answered, and had to smile too. I remembered how sometimes in the past she had taken the same tone in exasperation at my pedantry. That memory effaced the danger. "But I'm here," I said. She shook her head, and I saw that her eyes were filled with tears.
"Not yet," she answered. "Not yet. And now come along, or they really will arrest us. It looks as if I were making a scene."
We crossed the square. "I can't come with you right away," I said. "We'll have to send the maid away first." I've taken a room in a hotel in Munster. No one knows me in Munster. My idea was to stay there. She stopped still.
For how long?
I don't know, I answered. I've never been able to think ahead. All I knew was that I wanted to see you, and that I'd have to go back sometime.
Across the border?
Of course. She bowed her head and went on. I reflected that I should now be very happy, but I didn't feel that way. It's only later that you really feel it. Now I know that I was happy. I've got to call Martin's, I said.
You can call him from your apartment, Helen replied.
It gave me a jolt every time she said, your apartment. She was doing it on purpose, I didn't know why. I promised Martin's to call him in an hour, I said. That means now. If I don't call, he'll think something has gone wrong. He might do something foolish.
He knows I was going to meet you.
I looked at my watch. I ought to have called 15 minutes before. I'll call him from the nearest cafe, I said. It will only take a second.
Goodness, Yosef, said Helen angrily. You really haven't changed. You're even more pedantic than you used to be.
Maybe so, I said. But I know from experience what calamities can come from inattention to details, and I also know what it feels like to wait when there's danger in the air. I took her arm. If I weren't pedantic, Helen, I wouldn't be alive. She pressed my arm.
I know,
she murmured. But don't you understand that I'm afraid something will happen if I leave you alone for 1 minute? I felt all the warmth in the world. Nothing will happen, Helen. She smiled and raised her pale face.
Go telephone, but not in a cafe. There's a booth over there. They put it up while you were away. It's safer than a cafe.
I went into the glass booth. Helen stayed outside. I called Martin's. The line was busy. I waited a little while and called again. The coin was returned with a tinkle. The line was still busy. I grew anxious. Through the glass, I could see Helen pacing attentively back and forth. I motioned to her, but she didn't see me. She was watching the street, but trying not to show it. Sentinel and guardian angel in one, in a very becoming suit, as I now noticed. I also saw, as I waited, that she had on lipstick. In the yellow light, it seemed almost black. I remembered that rouge and lipstick were frowned on in the New Germany. At the third attempt, Martins answered.
My wife was on the phone, he said. For almost half an hour, I couldn't interrupt her.
Where is she now?
In the kitchen. I had to let her talk, you understand?
Of course I do. Everything is all right. Thank you, Rudolph. Forget you saw me.
Where are you?
In the street. Thank you, Rudolph. I don't need anything now. I've found what I was looking for.
We're together.
I looked at Helen through the glass wall and wanted to hang up.
Do you know where you'll stay?
Martins asked. I think so. Don't worry. Forget this evening. Pretend you dreamt it.
If there's anything else I can do, he said hesitantly, let me know. I was too surprised at first. You understand?
Yes, Rudolph, I understand. If I need anything, I'll let you know.
If you want to spend the night here, we could talk.
I smiled. We'll see. I've got to hang up now.
Yes, of course, he said quickly. Forgive me. I wish you the best of luck, Yosef. I really do.
Thank you, Rudolph. I stepped out of the airless telephone booth. A gust of wind nearly blew my hat off. Helen rushed over to me.
Come home now. You've infected me with your caution. I feel as if 100 eyes were staring at us out of the darkness.
Have you still the same maid?
Lena? No, she was spying for my brother. He wanted to know if you wrote me, or if I wrote you.
And the present one?
She's dumb and she doesn't care what I do. If I give her the weekend off, she'll be delighted. She won't think anything.
You haven't sent her away yet?
She smiled and was very beautiful. I had to make sure you were really here.
You've got to get rid of her before I come in, I said. She mustn't see us.
Couldn't we go somewhere else? Where?
Where indeed?
Helen laughed. Here we stand like two teenagers, wondering where they can meet in secret because their parents think they're too young. Where can we go? To the castle park? It's closed at 8 o'clock. Sit on a bench in the municipal gardens, a pastry shop? That would be dangerous.
She was right. These were the details that I had not foreseen.
You never do.
Yes, I said. Here we stand like teenagers. I looked at her. She was 29, but she hadn't changed. The 5 intervening years had slid off her like water from a young seal.
I came here like a teenager, too, I said. All reason was against it. But I didn't think ahead. I didn't even know whether you were married to me or to somebody else.
She did not answer. Her brown hair shone in the light of the street lamp.
I'll go ahead and send the girl away, she said. But I hate leaving you alone in the street. You might disappear as suddenly as you came. Where will you go in the meantime?
Where you found me, in a church. I could go back to the cathedral. Churches are safe, Helen. I've become an expert on French, Swiss, and Italian churches and museums.
Come back in 30 minutes, she whispered. Do you remember the windows of our apartment?
Yes, I said.
If the corner window is open, the coast is clear and you can come up. If it's closed, wait until I open it.
I was reminded of my childhood, when I had played Indians with martens. In those days the signal had been a light in the window. Old Shatterhand or Winnetou would be waiting down below.
Did life repeat itself?
Could anything really be repeated?
Good, I said, and began to walk away. Where are you going?
I'll see if St. Mary's is still open. If my memory doesn't deceive me, it's a fine example of Gothic architecture. I've learned to appreciate those things.
Stop the nonsense, she said. It's bad enough having to leave you alone.
Helen, I answered, I've learned to take care of myself. She shook her head. The bravery went out of her face.
Not well enough, she said. Not well enough. What will I do if you don't come back?
There's nothing you can do. Your telephone number's still the same, isn't it?
Yes.
I touched her shoulder. Helen, I said, everything will be all right. She nodded.
I'll take you to St. Mary's. I want to be sure you get there.
We walked in silence. It was not far. Helen left me without a word. I looked after her as she crossed the old marketplace. She walked quickly, without looking back. I stopped in the darkness beneath the portal. To the right lay the city hall, in shadow except for the carved stone faces, which caught a faint glow of moonlight. In 1648, the end of the 30 Years' War had been proclaimed on the steps outside that city hall. So had the beginning of the 1,000-year Reich in 1933. I wondered whether I would live to witness the announcement of its end. I had little hope. I did not try to go inside the church. I was suddenly repelled by the idea of hiding. I was still determined to be careful, but since I had seen Helen, I didn't want to act like a hunted animal anymore, unless I had to. Still, it wouldn't be safe to stay here too long, so I began to stroll about. The city, which before had seemed dangerous, familiar, and at the same time strange,
now came to life. I sensed that this was so because I myself had begun to live. It came to me that my anonymous existence of the last few years, which had seemed so empty, a sheer fight for survival, had not been so useless. It had molded me, and now, like a flower that had opened during the night, a sense of life that I had not known before was within me. There was nothing romantic about it, but it was new and exciting, as if an enormous, bright-colored, tropical bloom had appeared by magic on a common garden plant that might at best have been expected to produce a measly bud or two. I came to the river, stopped on the bridge, and looked down over the rail at the water. To the left of me stood a medieval watchtower, which now housed a laundry. The windows were lighted, and the girls were still at work. The light came blowing across the river in broad beams. The black wall with the linden trees stood out against the tall sky, and to the right lay gardens and the silhouette of the cathedral. I stood very still, completely relaxed. There was nothing to be heard but the splashing of the water and the muffled voices of the laundry girls behind the windows. I couldn't make out what they were saying. All I heard seemed to be human sounds that had not yet shaped themselves into words, signs of human presence, but not yet, as finished words would have been, signs of falsehood, betrayal, stupidity, and frantic loneliness, ugly overtones disfiguring what had been conceived as a pure melody. I breathed, and it seemed to me that I was breathing in the same rhythm as the water. For a timeless moment, I even felt that I was part of the bridge, that the water was flowing through me with my breath. This seemed perfectly natural, and I was not surprised. I didn't think. My thoughts had become as unconscious as my breathing in the water. A subdued light moved quickly through the line of lindens at my left. My eyes followed it, and then I heard the voices of the girls again. I realized that for a time I had not heard them, and again I noticed the smell of the lindens carried across the water by the breeze. The moving light went out, and at the same time the windows behind me darkened. For a minute the water lay black as pitch. Then I saw the little spangles of moonlight that had been drowned out by the light of the laundry. Now that the moonlight was alone, its play was more delicate and varied than the coarse yellow light it had replaced. I thought of my life, in which years before a light had been extinguished, and I wondered whether a multitude of soft lights that I had never seen before might not reappear in it, like the sparkling moonlight on the river. Until then, I had only been aware of my loss. It had never occurred to me that I might have gained something by it. I left the bridge and walked back and forth between the dark lines of trees on the ramparts until the half hour was up. The smell of the lindens grew stronger as the night advanced, and the moon sprinkled the roofs and towers with silver. It was as though the city were doing everything in its power to show me that I had built up a lie, that there was no danger lurking in wait for me anywhere, that I could go home with an easy heart after a long and aimless journey to be myself again. There was no need to be on my guard against this feeling. Something within me watched of its own accord, peering out in all directions. Too many times I had been arrested in Paris, Rome, and other cities in exactly this state of mind, surrendering to beauty and lulled to security by delusions of love, understanding, and forgetfulness. The police never forgot. Moonlight and the scent of linden trees didn't make saints of stool pigeons. Cautiously, my senses alert like bats' wings, I made my way to Hitlerplatz. The house was on a corner where a street entered the square. The street still had its old name. The window was open.
I remembered the story of Hero and Leander and the fairy tale about the prince and princess in which the nun puts out the light and the prince drowns. I wasn't a prince, I thought. The Germans had lots of beautiful fairy tales, nevertheless, or perhaps for that very reason, the most revolting concentration camps in the world. Calmly I crossed the street, and it was not the Hellespont, and not a northern sea. When I reached the entrance, I saw someone coming down the hallway. It was too late to turn back. I walked on toward the stairs with an air of knowing where I was going. It was an elderly woman I had never seen before. My heart stood still. Schwartz smiled. That's another cliché that you don't believe until you've felt it. I didn't look around. I heard the house door close and ran quickly up the steps. The door was slightly ajar. I pushed it open, and there was Helen.
"Did anyone see you?" she asked.
"Yes, an old woman."
"Without a hat?"
"Yes, without a hat."
"It must have been the maid. Her room is in the attic. I gave her off until Monday afternoon. She must have spent all that time primping. She thinks people have nothing else to do than to find fault with her dress."
"Don't worry about her," I said. Whether it was she or not, she didn't recognize me. I know when somebody recognizes me. Helen took my raincoat and hat. She was going to hang them in the vestibule. "Don't leave them here," I said. "Somebody might see them. Put them in a closet."
"Nobody will be coming," said Helen, and led the way to the living room.
Before following her, I turned the key in the lock. In the first years of my exile, I had often thought of my home. Then I had tried to forget it. Now that I was in it, I didn't feel much. It affected me like a picture that had once belonged to me and that reminded me of a certain period of my life. I stood in the doorway. Hardly anything had changed. The couch and the chairs had been done over. "Weren't they green before?" I asked.
"Blue," said Helen.
Schwartz turned to me. "Things have a life of their own, and it's terrible when you compare them to yours."
"Why make comparisons?" I asked.
"Don't you?"
"Yes, but in a different way. I stick to myself. When I'm hungry on the waterfront, I compare myself with an imaginary me who, in addition to being hungry, has cancer. That makes me happy for a minute because I'm only hungry, without the cancer."
"Cancer," said Schwartz and stared at me. "What makes you think of that?"
"I could have said syphilis or tuberculosis. Cancer seemed the most plausible."
"Plausible?" Schwartz was still looking fixedly at me. "There's nothing plausible about cancer. It's unthinkable."
"All right," I said in a conciliatory tone. "I just took it as an example."
"It's simply inconceivable."
"That's true of every fatal illness, Mr. Schwartz."
He nodded in silence. "Are you still hungry?" he asked after a while.
"No, why?"
"You said something about hunger."
"I've eaten dinner twice since I've been with you."
He was silent. After a while, he said more calmly, "The chairs were yellow. They had been done over. That was all that had happened there in 5 years, while I had been suffering all the ironies of fate. Sometimes things are incongruous. That's what I meant."
"Yes," I said. "A man dies, but his bed is still there. His house is still there. Objects remain as they were. If we could only destroy them, too."
"Not if they don't mean anything to us."
"That's right," I said. "Besides, a human life isn't that important."
"No," said Schwartz, and there was agony in the face he raised to me. "Not important?" "No, of course not. But tell me, If a life isn't important, what is?
Nothing,
I said, knowing even as I spoke that it was true and yet untrue. It's we ourselves who make things important. Schwartz took a quick gulp of the dark wine.
And why not?
He asked in a loud voice. Can you tell me why we shouldn't make them important?
No, I can't tell you that. Anyway, it was just a silly manner of speaking. I myself take life seriously enough.
I looked at my watch. It was a little after 2. The band was playing dance music, a tango. The short, muted notes of the horn reminded me of the far-off sirens of a departing ship. Only a few hours until dawn, I thought. Then I'll be able to get out of here. I felt for the tickets in my pocket. They were still there. I had almost expected them not to be. The unaccustomed music, the wine, the curtained room, and Schwartz's voice created an atmosphere of drowsy unreality.
I was still in the doorway of the living room, Schwartz went on. Helen looked at me and asked, "Has your home become so strange to you?" I shook my head and took a few steps forward. A curious embarrassment had come over me. The objects in the room seemed to be reaching out for me, but I no longer belonged to them. Perhaps I no longer belonged to Helen either.
Everything is the same, I said quickly, with a desperate fervor. Everything is the same, Helen.
No, she answered. Nothing is the same. Why have you come back? For that? So everything would be the same?
No, I said. I know that can't be.
But didn't we live here? Where are those years?
Not here. And they aren't in the old clothes that we've thrown away. Or is that what you thought?
No, I'm not asking for myself, but you've been here the whole time. I'm asking for you.
Helen gave me a strange look.
Why didn't you ever think of that before? She said.
Before? I asked, uncomprehending. What do you mean? I couldn't come back any sooner.
That's not what I mean. I mean before you went away.
I didn't understand. What should I have asked, Helen? She did not reply at once. Then she said quickly,
Why didn't you ask me to go with you?
I stared at her.
With me?
To leave your home, your family, everything you loved?
I hate my family.
I was utterly bewildered. You don't know what it's like out there, I murmured finally.
You didn't either, then.
That was true. I didn't want to take you away from here, I said feebly.
I hate it, she answered. I hate everything here. Why have you come back?
You didn't hate it then.
Why have you come back? She repeated.
She was standing at the other end of the room, separated from me by the yellow chairs and more than 5 years. A wave of hostility and bitterness struck me full in the face. At the time of my flight, my conduct had seemed perfectly natural. How could I involve Helen in the dangers and uncertainties of a life in exile? Now it came to me that perhaps I had offended her deeply by running off and leaving her alone.
Why have you come back, Josef? She asked.
I should have liked to say that I had come back for her sake, but at the moment I couldn't. It was not so simple. I saw what I had never seen before. What had driven me back was a quiet, stark desperation. My reserves had been used up. My naked instinct of self-preservation had not been strong enough to endure the chill of loneliness any longer. I had not been able to build up a new life. In my heart, I had never really wanted to, because I had never really put my old life behind me. I couldn't forget it, and I couldn't overcome it. Gangrene had set in, and I had to choose. I could let myself rot away, or I could go back and try to get well. I had never figured all this out, and even now it was only half clear to me. But it was an enormous relief to know even as much as I did. My feeling of oppression and embarrassment left me. Now I knew why I was here. From 5 years of exile, I had brought nothing with me but my sharpened senses, an eagerness to live, and the caution and experience of a fugitive criminal. In all other respects, I was bankrupt. The nights in the no man's land between borders, the cruel boredom of a life spent fighting for a little food and a few hours of sleep, the underground existence of a mole. All this fell away from me as I stood there on the threshold of my home. I was bankrupt, but at least I had no debts. I was free. This was not a return. The self of those years had committed suicide when I crossed the border. It was dead. Another self was alive, and it was a gift, involving no responsibility. Schwartz turned to me. Do you know what I mean? I repeat myself and talk in contradictions. I think I understand you, I answered. The possibility of committing suicide is a blessing, though we seldom appreciate it. It gives you the illusion of free will. And probably we commit suicide more often than we suspect. We just don't know it. That's it, said Schwartz eagerly. If we only knew it for suicide, then we'd also be able to rise from the dead. We'd have several lives instead of dragging the ulcers of experience from one crisis to the next and succumbing to them in the end. Of course, I couldn't explain that to Helen, he continued, and I didn't have to. All at once, I felt so light that there was no need to explain. On the contrary, I felt that explanations would only make for confusion. She probably wanted me to say that I had come back on her account. But I knew with my new insight that that would have been my ruin. The past would have broken over us with all its reproaches, with all its guilt and lost opportunities and offended love, and we would never have found our way out. If this idea of spiritual suicide, which now seemed almost joyful, was to have any meaning, it had to be complete. It had to take in not only the years of exile, but also the years before it. Otherwise, a second gangrene, even older than the first, would set in. Helen stood there, an enemy, ready to strike out at me with love and an exact knowledge of my vulnerable points, and I wouldn't have had a chance. The suicide that had held out hope of liberation would become an excruciating moral agony, no longer death followed by resurrection, but complete annihilation. It is a mistake to explain too much to women. The thing to do is to act. I approached Helen. When I touched her shoulder, I felt her tremble. Why have you come? She asked again. I've forgotten, I said. I'm hungry, Helen. I haven't had anything to eat all day. Beside her, on a little painted Italian table, was the silver-framed photograph of a man I did not know. Do we need that? I asked. No, she said in surprise. She took the picture and shoved it into the table drawer. Schwartz looked at me and smiled. She didn't throw it away, he said. She didn't tear it up. She put it in the drawer. She'd be able to take it out and set it up again any time she pleased. I don't know why, but the discreet calculation of her gesture delighted me. 5 years before, I would not have understood it. I would have made a scene. Now it put an end to a situation that was threatening to get stuffy. We can stomach big words in politics, but not in love, unfortunately. It would be better the other way around. Helen's rationalistic gesture was not loveless. This was love seasoned with feminine perspicacity. I had disappointed her once. Why should she be in any hurry to trust me? I, for my part, hadn't lived in France for nothing. I asked no questions. And what could I have asked? And by what right? I laughed. She was taken aback. Then her face brightened, and she laughed too. Tell me, I asked, have you divorced me? She shook her head. No, I refused, but not on your account. It was to annoy my family.